This is HPR episode 2863 entitled, Simplified Application Architectures for Improved Security. It is hosted by Beezer, and is about 16 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, a thought experiment in whether reducing runtime dependencies can improve security, and how to do it.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hello again, this is Beezer on Hacker Public Radio. Whenever I install a new Linux application, I'm often struck by the large number of dependencies that are installed alongside it. We accept it as part and parcel of the way applications are constructed, but it raises an issue which is becoming increasingly important in our area of cybercrime and cyberterrorism. Every interface between the components in an application is an attack surface. So that being the case, then every dependency represents a potential vulnerability. The greater the number of dependencies, the greater the potential for the application to be compromised in one way or another. It must follow then that if we reduce the number of dependencies an application relies upon, then the more secure that application will be. Well, that got me wondering how realistic it would be to change the way applications are developed and the implications that would bring with it. When I first started developing software in the mid-1980s, it was on a VAX computer running the VMS operating system. The projects I worked on used Fortran and a language called Coral 66, which was the standard in the defence industry before Ada took over from it. Now the workflow was the same for each, a simple three-stage process. You wrote your code, you compiled it into an object file, and then use the linker to produce the executable. If you were working alone, then there was usually just a single object file, but depending on how you chose to organise your project, you might have several, which was sometimes a handy approach if you wanted to reuse code across multiple projects. At the end of that process, you had a single executable which could, in principle, be copied to any other VAX with the same version of VMS running on it, and the application would run fine. It made the distribution and the installation of the application very simple. If I look at the way applications are structured now, whether it's on Linux, Windows or Mac, it's all very different. There are thousands of libraries providing functionality which, in theory, can be shared by any application designed to use them. It's a powerful approach which removes the need for developers to be forever writing new code to deliver what is really fundamental or generic functionality. It does, however, make the distribution and the installation of an application a lot more complex. While it is the way developers have become accustomed to working, is it really the right way in this day and age when security considerations ought to outweigh simple convenience? Could there be an alternative approach which simplifies application architectures and in doing so improve security, while coincidentally providing a big win for open source software? Before I elaborate, I'll just make it clear that I'm a huge supporter of free software as defined by the FSF. In this context, though, I really do mean open source software, software whose source code is available to view, regardless of whether the license attached to it is free or comes with some kind of restriction. It's probably best to start with a view of how things have come to be the way they are now. When the personal computer first became mainstream, memory was both expensive to buy and it was in short supply in terms of how much of it your PC could address. 640k was the limit on early PCs. The amount of disk space you could use was less restricted by the operating system, but highly restricted by the depth of your pockets. My first PC, an Amstrad 1512, came with a single 7-inch floppy disk drive, and the disk it could read held just 360k. What I really wanted, though, was to get into the big league and have a hard disk. Eventually I bought one, and it cost me £200, which at the time was best part of a week's wages, and it had a capacity of 20 megabytes. Yeah, you heard that right, megabytes. With those kinds of restrictions, there was a huge incentive to keep application executables as small as possible. Now, fortunately, in those early days when everything ran in text mode, the amount of memory required to render your user interface was small. In about 6K of memory, you could define an entire screen displaying the standard 80 by 25 character matrix, including the foreground and the background 8-bit colours for each. That is, if you had a colour monitor, which was far from standard in those days. That still left most of your RAM available for the operating system and the applications to run in. The introduction of graphics mode changed all that. If you were lucky, your monitor had a graphics resolution of 640 by 480 pixels, and that could generate the same 16 colours. It made for a much sharper and more useful display, but suddenly you could be close to using half your RAM just to render an image on your monitor. That provided even more incentive to keep applications small. As time went by, Microsoft developed what can only really be described as workarounds to allow the operating system to address memory above 640k. This was the so-called upper memory, which enabled a total of 1024k, or 1 megabyte, to be addressed. Eventually that progressed further still, and we got extended memory, which in theory provided the potential up to 4 gigabytes of RAM. I say in theory because that kind of RAM just wasn't available at that time for any price. In 1990, when companies were just beginning to take Microsoft Windows seriously, the IBM PS2 was pretty much the benchmark machine for corporate buyers, and that typically came with no more than 2 megabytes of RAM and a hard disk of perhaps 40 megabytes. At that time, Windows was really just a graphical interface to DOS. In fact, by default, your computer would still boot to a DOS prompt, and it was only through a command in your AutoExec file that you end up in Windows on startup. Now, with DOS and Windows running, you're eating up a lot of that very limited memory and using a substantial chunk of your hard disk as well. And that's before you installed and ran any applications over what came standard with Windows. Now, fortunately, Windows had a trick up its sleeve to make the most of those meager resources. This was the Dynamic Link Library. This was essentially a new executable file which could be called by any application that happened to be running. The clever part was that a copy was only loaded into memory by the first application calling it. Any subsequent application calling it would use that same copy. This meant that the use of memory was optimised, and through the liberal use of standardised DLLs delivered as part of the operating system, the size of the application's own executable could be reduced, thereby easing the demand for both disk space and RAM. The typical amount of disk space available on a PC grew a lot faster than did the typical amount of RAM. Microsoft addressed this fact and implemented more and more functional components of Windows as DLLs. It meant that a well-crafted Windows application could minimise its own compiled size. So the introduction of fundamental runtime components in Visual Basic and Visual C++ automated this principle. The application executable would make most of its calls to the runtime, and the runtime was designed to devolve those calls to the appropriate DLLs. Each of the big three operating systems in widespread use today employs this principle of functional devolution, which ensures developers are not forever reinventing the wheel. It's a principle which does, however, sometimes create a cascade of dependencies. In its worst cases, the existence of some of those dependencies may be mutually exclusive, resulting in applications which cannot be run in the standard operating system environment. On Linux, new packaging technologies such as Snap, Flatpak and AppImage have been developed to address this scenario by installing an application into a compartmentalized environment. But the application still has the same number of dependencies, each of which represents a potential security vulnerability. When we look at a typical laptop or desktop today, there's no fair comparison with the PCs of the 80s and 90s. both RAM and disk space had multiplied by a factor of well over 1,000 to levels which would have seemed miraculous in the days of the PS2. I have a display of memory and CPU usage on my Linux desktop, but neither often exceeds 25% of what is available, and even when it does, it's only for the briefest periods. Well, there'll always be some users, like gamers and graphics people, who flog their machines to the maximum for most of the time, of course, but they are the exception. Most desktop class computers have far more RAM than they ever really need for a typical use. It would seem then that we are still constructing our applications according to the practicalities and the constraints of 30 years ago rather than the realities of today. And in doing so, we're creating opportunities for attackers which could be significantly reduced if we made better use of the kind of resources available to the average present-day computer. So how do we simplify the architecture and application? Well, in principle, we just need to internalise as far as possible the functionality which is currently delegated to external libraries. I say just, but how simple that is depends on a number of factors. If your application is developed using a compiled language, then libraries can be statically linked at compile time so that their functionality becomes embedded within the application's executable. That means gathering object files for all the libraries you'll be calling and then linking them to the object file of your application. Perhaps in time it will be possible to create object file repositories, but most straightforward way to obtain them at the moment would be for the application developer to compile them from source. Now, all mainstream compiled languages, as far as I'm aware, can be linked to libraries coded in different language. Typically, it'll be C or C++. But what happens, though, if you've developed your application in an interpreted language such as Python? Now, I'm no Python expert, but I believe it'll be necessary to translate the source of the library, or at least the parts that you need to use, into the same language. Of course, executable libraries do get upgraded from time to time, so how do we ensure that those changes get propagated into every application that has its functionality embedded through code inclusion or static linking? Well, on the face of it, that's a hell of a problem, but let's look at the evolution of a library compared with the evolution of an application. When the library is an external object called dynamically runtime, as long as the interface remains unchanged, a new version can be installed without any change required to the application that calls it. That's very handy. However, why would a library need to change anyway? Once its core functionality is proven and trusted, there may be a change to improve performance, but the likelihood is that the main driver for change will be security, and the impact of that will almost certainly be at the interface. However, if that interface is not exposed, due to being within the application instead of external to it, then it ceases to be a consideration. There's probably no need to modify the expanded application code or relink against an updated object file. In effect, if the library developer publishes a new version, since it's open source, the developer of any application that uses it can study the release notes and decide whether any change to the application is needed. It scarcely needs to be pointed out that as more logic is encapsulated in an application, the bigger will become its executable. Now, I've already addressed the fact that for the majority of use cases, a modern computer has plenty of surplus memory and plenty of storage. Accommodating and running larger executables should really not be an issue. I acknowledge that the theoretical advantage of load once, run many times that applies to many libraries will be lost. Again, though, with the resource profile of a modern computer, that's hardly an issue at the application level. I would agree, though, that at the operating system level, where a low-level function may be called a huge number of times, you'd not want a separate copy loaded every time. I stress, however, for the purposes of this discussion, I'm really looking just at menu-level applications. So to summarise, what is it that I'm suggesting? Well, I'm proposing that the installation architecture of menu-level applications be simplified by reducing the number of external dependencies. The purpose? By reducing the number of dependencies, you reduce the number of interfaces and thereby the number of attack surfaces. So what are the downsides? Well, there's several. Agreeing and implementing new ways of managing libraries would need to be found. Given that phasing out most external dependencies would take a long time, it would require repositories of object files and source translations to be maintained in parallel, and that's no small task. Application developers will need to keep a watch on the third-party code or object files they use and assess what impact any changes have on their application. Now, that's potentially a long-term commitment. So is anybody actually going to do this? Is anybody going to say, you know, that bloke Beezer from HPR is right. I'm going to re-engineer all my applications to get rid of external dependencies. Well, no, of course not. The effort and organisational changes seem hard to justify at the moment. However, cyber attacks are not going to go away. If anything, they're going to increase both in number and in sophistication. The time will come when the industry starts to look for additional ways in which an application can be made less vulnerable. Now, I don't in any way claim to have followed every strand of this idea to its logical conclusion, but fundamentally, though, I do believe that reducing the number of external dependencies an application uses has got to reduce its vulnerability to attack. The installation architectures we use nowadays are convenient, but they have arisen from the need to operate within the technical constraints of decades ago. Convenience can no longer be the overriding consideration, but that's not to say new ways of working cannot become equally convenient once they've become established. There's a big advantage here for open source software. Proprietary software developers are not going to willingly open source their products or provide object files for third-party developers to link against, as it could open the door to a measure of reverse engineering. Software security people have to acknowledge that there are practical limits to which a lot of proprietary software can be simplified architecturally in order to increase security. In total contrast, developers of open source software, who are already able to audit and verify every line of code that makes up their application, will be able to give additional reassurances regarding security by virtue of that simplified architecture. Just a thought. Bye.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.